Hi. Thanks, Fatima. Thanks for letting me give a talk. So, yeah, I think it's officially called the discussion. That means shut me up, talk, whatever, let's discuss. But since I'm not tenured yet, some chunk of this will be my work, and then some chunk of this will be other people's. But what I wanted to do is maybe the first page of my notes, page and a half, is things that I think about in Flowcade, things that I think are interesting, kind of generically, to give a broad overview for those who are interested. And then I'll talk about one particular unpublished piece of work that we're writing up right now. Jeez Louise, there's a lot of small chalk here. All right. So, periodic drive. Why should you care? Some chunk of the people in this room I see are from the cold atom or universality program. You care certainly because quantum optics is a Flowcade system. To some extent, like if you're doing, I don't know, optical lattices, Stark physics, it's a dumb Flowcade system in the sense that it is just very, very high frequency, much, much higher than any other scale in the problem. You're doing basically perturbation theory on that drive, but is incredibly useful. It is incredibly useful. And so the question that I maybe generally think is worth addressing and that I get pretty excited by is, so periodic drive, aka Flowcade, even though Flowcade pretty much did math and didn't really care about the drives as far as I can tell, is useful for what? Well, one thing that is most obviously demonstrated by quantum optics, but has been pushed more recently, is engineering. It's one of the most powerful tools to create some interesting quantum system that you can't easily create otherwise. So lasers are periodic drives. Clearly, if you've ever seen a, you know, cold atom optics table, they're useful, and you need a lot of them. And that is why I'm not an experimentalist. But they're also useful in other limits where it's not so obvious. Oh, I've got two pieces of chalk. Not so obvious what you would do. So the biggest thing is, let's say, the kind of basic tools of quantum optics. But there are also some less frequency-separated versions. So, for example, one thing, one of the first things that was demonstrated using Flowcade drive, it's a phenomenon known as coherent destruction of tunneling. This was actually done first in, I think, solid-state quantum wells, but also works in various atomic-type setups. And the idea here is you basically take two wells, and they are, let's say, tunneled-coupled, so there's some tunneling T, and they also have some detuning delta. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to shake this delta as a function of time. And what you can show, actually, through a very simple trick, which I probably won't go over, is that if I shake at the right frequency, which is basically the amplitude over the frequency happens to be a zero of the zeroth Bessel function, I can actually completely eliminate tunneling between these wells, coherent destruction of tunneling. And there's a whole series expansion that actually tells you all the other corrections to this. This is interesting. This has been demonstrated in, again, as I say, various solid-state and cold atom systems. You start to really, really care about these types of methods because recently, basically the same physics has been used to design flux lattices. Actually, maybe I'm getting the terminology wrong. It's also known as called synthetic gauge fields in cold atoms, and the idea is very similar. What I'm going to do now is I'm going to tilt my entire system along one direction. Along the other direction, it's kind of abnormally, but it's along this direction, it's tilted. Then I'm going to either shake the tilt, or more accurately, I'm going to apply a pair of Raman beams, such that I'm going to re-enable the tunneling, but when I re-enable the tunneling, I pick up the phase of the Raman beams, and that actually, when I hop around a loop non-trivially, gives me a flux, allows me to do all of these cold atom synthetic gauge field experiments. And again, you can really think of these as Flowcade engineering tricks. Most of these are enabled by what's called the high-frequency expansion, which is that I basically, start out, go to a rotating frame where my drive is very, very fast, and then there's a very nice controlled expansion, which I think I'll go over a little bit more later, that lets me know my effective Hamiltonian in this rotating frame as a series in 1 over omega. This is very useful from an engineering standpoint. My interest, I mean, I have a little bit that I can say about this, is not so much what you can do with Floquet, that in principle you could have done other ways. So this is all kind of like getting effective Hamiltonians. But how is Floquet new? What does it give you that's fundamentally different? And one of the things that's really emerged in the last, say, 3 to 5 years is topological phases that are fundamentally Floquet. So one of the big drivers of this field is Mark Rudner, whom if you saw his talk, it's like the start of the conference here. So clearly interesting to this community, but he and Nate Lindner, Erisberg, and a few others have really been pushing this idea, and the idea is very simple. When you define a topological phase in normal solid-state systems, the way you do it is you kind of think about very curvature and momentum space. So I have some Brillouin zone, which is compact. I ask how kind of my wave function wraps around the Brillouin zone or my eigenstates wrap. When I have a Floquet system, I have one more compact direction, and that is time. It's periodic. If you like, you can also think about it as frequency is now only defined on the torus. And that could be one extra direction to topologize. And it turns out this is actually a very powerful tool to get new phases of matter. The first one that I'm aware of, though please correct me if I'm missing something, is a phase. It's a version of a topological superconductor that has modes known as pi-Majoranis, which are basically, here's my topological superconductor, it's gapped, but I have Majorana N modes, and these guys are Majoranas, they're equal to their dagger, but now if I go and I periodically drive them and I start out at gamma at time zero and I do my full unitary for one cycle, I come back to myself up to a minus. So picking up a pi Berry phase, if you like, is my pi quasi-energy, and this is what's called a pi Majorana. Another maybe easier to see phase is, again, by these people, Mark and others, called the anomalous Floquet-Anderson insulator. And actually, you don't need the insulating piece, it's just the easiest way to get it, where you shake your system. It's actually a very simple shaking scheme, in such a way that if I'm sitting in the bulk, everything just kind of goes in these closed loops. You can show it's topologically trivial in the sense that it has no churn number, but then you look at the edges and try to figure out where the edge states go, and you find that there's kind of no other way to complete it besides having these edge states flow around. And furthermore, the Anderson insulator part is now I add disorder to this system, or they assume MBL, though I don't think it's proven. These guys all get localized, but the edge states stay. And you can actually show that this can't happen. It's fundamentally not allowed in the absence of driving. What the driving does for you is actually gives you this new topological invariant, which you can think of as not the effective Hamiltonian. It's never a question of the effective Hamiltonian, but rather an effect of the micromotion. So what's happening within a cycle, that's these little loops, that's a very non-trivial thing in the bulk, and that's actually what gives you new topological invariants.
Please. So for this, with disorder for this Floquet and the insulator, how can you calculate the
invariant? The invariant, so it's actually exactly the same way that you would do it in a disordered system that does not have Floquet, which is, I imagine, I take my system, you want to remove the edge state, so I'm going to wrap it onto a very large torus, and so my physical system is going to be on a physical real space torus. Just learned how to draw these last year, I was really excited. Flux coming through one direction, flux coming through the other direction are now my periodic variables.
Basically, you use twist the boundary conditions.
Or twisting the boundary conditions. And what you can show is, because now really these guys are Anderson insulating, they just don't respond to these twisted boundary conditions. I mean, the amount that they disperse as a function of these boundary conditions is much less than even their very small energy gaps. And so there's a meaningfully defined sense in which these guys are all separate. And therefore, I can define really actually a Chern number with respect to phi 1 and phi 2. But the trick is either I can define it in terms of the micro motion, which is a little harder to do, or what I can do is what's called the Floquet extended zone, where I take my Hamiltonian and then I create many copies of it corresponding to basically absorbing n photons. And what you see is in the bulk, there are no Chern numbers, everything is boring. Somewhere deep out in infinity, there's a Chern carrying band, which is kind of what gives you this micro motion.
So, also, you mentioned that there's no proof yet, right, for this Anderson.
For the Anderson, it's proven. It's numerically strongly argued. For MBL.
No, I mean, just for Flaquet Anderson
theory. No, I think that's proven. I mean, they have very strong numerics.
If you do not have Draven, I know there is a proof. But if you have Draven, I mean, for this Anderson insulator, is there any...
Oh, a proof that it can Anderson insulate?
Sorry?
I'm not understanding the question.
In the presence of the periodic driving,
yes.
Then it heats, I guess it's worried it heats up to infinite temperature.
No, this is 9-hacking
system. Yeah. So it doesn't do that because it Anderson insulates.
I mean, just for this 9-hacking case, for this Anderson insulator, but with disorder in the driving, is there any mechanism?
Oh, disorder in the drive.
Yeah.
I understand.
Yeah.
No, I'm not aware of what exactly.
Yeah,
that's a very good question. If you were there for the conference, Anatoly, my ex-postdoc advisor, was like super interested in asking whether that's relevant. My intuition, I will tell you, is that this actually doesn't survive disorder in the drive. It's a very different direction. And the reason is essentially this comes back to coherence among most. I mean, at the naivest level, a drive is like noise, and noise is going to heat you up. At the slightly less naive level, if you think about I have some noise on the drive, I can think of that as some external parameter that I'm very slowly ramping. And as I guess I'll show it. Something that was studied by, among others, Walter Cohen, the guy they were honoring yesterday, so that's this reference, is that in a Floquet system, as soon as they start to ramp things, it's very hard to define adiabaticity. So if you think of this guy as some ramping parameter, be it some magnetic field to put on the system, be it I slightly change my frequency very, very slowly, or if I have noise, then I may be going back and forth in this parameter space, something like that. And this is my actual energy of the system. Your usual adiabatic theorem says, okay, I have a bunch of levels, but they're spaced. They avoid crossing each other. So if I start here and I ramp slowly enough, I stay here. The trick is that this is an extensive system, which this guy is. So L to some spatial dimension is my energy bandwidth. But now, I drive at a frequency omega. In a Floquet system, the energy is only meaningfully defined. So this is what I would call the Floquet quasi-energies. Mod omega. So basically, I have to fold everything into one omegas of energy. So I now have a soup of levels. And what these guys showed is that basically, if I do that, there's no meaningful sense in which I can take one state and just track it cleanly across the system. It just, the words they use are a series of weaker and weaker avoided crossings. And basically, because of that, you do expect if you start to modify, say, lambda due to noise, what's going to happen is I'm going to start in something that is, nice and Anderson insulating, but then I'm going to get some weakly avoided crossings, which I bears mention is very, very similar to the story that Rahul and Shivaji and Vedika found when they looked at local perturbations in an Anderson insulator. It's a very similar story. You get very weakly avoided crossings, but if you go slow enough, game over. You tunnel across your system. It's a very good question. All right. Then the one other thing I wanted to say about this, which I better say because Bella's in the room, is there's one other version of this, which I guess I don't think of as a Floquet topological phase, but is very related. A fundamentally Floquet phase, which we've heard a lot about, is a time crystal. And they've done some seminal work showing that this guy can't exist in flow case systems. Maybe the interesting connection I would draw is that you can think of this as kind of the bulk dual version of this Pi-Majorana, well, at least the 2T periodic time crystal as the bulk version of a Pi-Majorana. Because, of course, these Pi-Majoranas themselves are technically time crystals. I don't know if you want to use that wording, but, you know, I come back to myself with a minus sign, I come back to myself with a plus sign after two cycles, and in some sense, it's a time crystal at the edge, and this guy is a time crystal at the bulk, which, as far as I can tell, is a very new phase of matter that in an isolated system should be hard to find in the absence of periodic drive. Probably, provably impossible to find. Is it proven? Strongly argued to be impossible to find.
Yeah.
In an isolated system. As soon as I add dissipation, which maybe in a second I'll talk about, the game changes. So this is why I think flow case is interesting. This is a discussion. Does anybody have like broad categories that they think also are interesting and I'm missing?
It looks like you're only talking about single mode. Have you thought at all about multi-frequency flow case?
Very good question. So I guess what I would say is formally, at least my understanding of the word flow case, is as soon as I do multi-mode, it's not flow case. That's my excuse for not putting it up here, but I will say that is actually very interesting.
There are generalizations.
There are generalizations, and I know that Professor Martin had a paper on this yesterday that I actually wanted to learn more about. So people have studied this. You see, for example, some very interesting localization physics in the single particle problem. But then there's some very interesting recent results on what happens when you hop in this kind of two-dimensional flow K lattice. And that's a very interesting question. So yes, let us add
this
two or more.
So but this case has been mostly studied for essentially single particle systems, right?
Yes.
Because then you can study localization, curve dimensions, and so on. But in the many body system, so do you expect something interesting could happen?
I honestly have just zero intuition on it. I think it's a fascinating problem to study. What I will say is, in the single particle problem, I agree, it's relatively tractable and there's some meaningful things you can say. If I go to many omegas, now this starts to look like a bath and I expect heating. Because one way of thinking about an actual bath is it's just a series of oscillators that is somehow able to shake my system. And
bath has to be continuous, right? So here you can drive.
It has to be continuous, but somehow if I go from two modes to three modes to five modes to 1,000 modes, at some point it starts to look like a bath. It's not a sharp transition, likely it's a crossover, or it's a sharp transition at two in the many body system. Those are kind of the two events that I could see happening. But if you have two incommensurate frequencies, either in the many body system it will heat no matter what, it's possible, but I doubt it, or there's really something meaningful you can say. And that's, as far as I can tell, an open question.
It's almost like adding another dimension, right?
Like getting another dimension. It is my opinion that you have to be careful when you talk. In the same way that you talk about these synthetic dimensions and cold atoms and you pretend, oh, it's a real another dimension, it is, if you're at the single particle level, if you don't worry about interactions and things like that. As soon as you put on the interactions there and here, it's a very different story. And just to emphasize why it's not just a trivial other dimension, you might think in these flow topological phases, I've told you there's one more compact direction. So let's say I have, you know, a two-dimensional system with no symmetries, that's class A. And I might ask, what are its topological invariants? You would say, okay, well, I have two spatial dimensions, one time dimension. Yeah, but time's basically space because it's compact. So I look in class A in three dimensions, and I find I think it's trivial. Correct me if I'm wrong.
There's a
hop index, but I'm not restricting myself to two bands here. So, yes, as in Joel's postdoc, I should have mentioned that. But no, here, infinite bands or whatever, because I'm localizing myself. And it's wrong. And it is actually characterized by the two-dimensional system. There's just kind of one extra gap which comes from wrapping around the Brillouin. So it's a little bit more subtle than adding an extra dimension, but certainly in some cases it looks pretty much exactly like that. For example, these kicked rotor localization experiments.
It's at least another degree of freedom.
It's definitely
it may
another
not
degree of freedom.
To another dimension.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Okay. Well, I think in kicked rotor, I mean, the reason that it's not exactly like extra dimension is because you have, in their delta function case, which basically in the Flicky lattice they take your arbitrary distance away. But if you're in harmonic drives or, you know, like, I don't know, a couple of harmonics, then, I mean, it does look very much like a...
I have to say, I don't think that's such a problem, because I think some of these kicked rotors, I haven't studied them in a great amount of detail. If you, you know, broaden out your delta function a little bit, now this looks like finite range hopping in this extra dimension, and I think the phase stays. I think it's robust to that.
Right. What I'm trying to say is that if you have, you know, simple drives, like, you know, sines, cosines, sort of single frequency, double frequency, I mean, then the mapping is direct. In the non-tracking case, every frequency gives you a dimension. And the only caveat is that you have built-in potential.
Yes.
So it's not like, you know, free lattice, and there is also, like, tilt potential. But,
again, at a mathematical single particle level, I kind of agree. I think if you really just restrict yourself to, say, a single spin or a single kicked rotor, then I think it's an exact mapping. If I start to do anything many body, I don't know that I believe it's quite the same level of exactness, particularly if I add interactions, because the interactions in time look, they're...
Right. So it will be definitely non-local in frequency space. So yeah, it's not easy to implement Hubbard models starting, let's say, from zero-dimensional, where you'd have non-local interaction velocity.
Yeah.
Some finite range interactions in frequency space, and this is true, I think.
Yeah. No, I mean, all I would say is it's a little bit more subtle than just direct. But in some cases, for example, I think in the paper you guys did, it really is an exact. And then it's a very, that's where you can do something very solid with it. So, good. Any other additions? All right. So, his wife Floquet is interesting. I mean, it's hard numerically to some extent. There's a lot that's open because you're periodically deriving its, excuse me, highly non-trivial system. So maybe here I'm going to try to write out some things that I think are open questions in Floquet systems. And again, let's add to this list. So in order to encompass pretty much everything that people will say broadly, can you classify and tell me how to measure new Floquet phases of matter? This is cheating, right? I mean, this is just, can you understand Floquet is an open question in Floquet. But maybe to be a little bit more explicit, for example, if you talked about topological phases, it's really now well understood that these are new phases. There's some periodic table you can design with them. In the presence of interactions, little corners of the table are understood. I will not pretend to be an expert on interacting topological phases well enough to say what's left to say there, but I do know there is a lot left to say there. So particularly in the presence of interactions, I would say this is interesting. And there, I guess you need MBL to say very much at all, which is related to point two. So these systems, because they are periodically driven, energy is not conserved. It's time to add Hamiltonian. If you had a very generic Hamiltonian and I don't give you energy conservation, the eigenstate thermalization hypothesis says you should go to infinite temperature, modulo any other conserved quantities. That is boring for most of us anyways. So the question is now, in a real lab, I do Floquet all the time. I don't find that my system, I don't know, all my atoms fly out of the trap and my glass gets shattered through because it's at infinite temperature. And so the question is, how do these systems heat? Why don't they heat immediately? And is there anything generic you can say in the preheating regime? And here, a lot has been done. Actually, I should probably have these reversed. I would say seminal starting work was by Dima and, what is it? Wojciech, and I'm forgetting Francois.
Yes.
In this work, and then with Wen Wei Ho, they had a few follow-ups. There's also been work done by the Saito group addressing very similar questions. And in both of these works, it's coming at it from a few different angles. Maybe Dima can clarify exactly which paper says what, but the upshot of it is that you can actually show in generic Floquet systems, if I drive it relatively fast, and fast is compared to some microscopic scale, which you have to be a little careful depending on the problem, you can actually show that these guys essentially can be described by some effective Hamiltonian up to very long time scales, exponentially long in something like the frequency of drive over a microscopic length scale. Please.
I would add that even if things do thermalize to infinite temperature, I'm not convinced that there's nothing interesting there. Because, in ETH would say that the reduced density matrix of a subregion will be 1. But it won't be exactly 1, there'll be subleading corrections to the ETH prediction. And there's actually universal content in those subleading corrections. So we examined entanglement spectrum, for instance, in the Floquet thermal phase, and the entanglement spectrum is completely dominated by the subleading corrections, and turns out to be governed by random matrix theory. So the leading piece is trivial, but I think there could still be some interesting physics lurking in the subleading structure.
Yeah, I wasn't familiar with. So, that's really cool, and I guess that's quite related to heating, because in the same sense that we can kind of write down effective Hamiltonians preheating, or what some people call pre-thermalization, presumably I can write down something like an effective Hamiltonian at late times that characterizes these subleading corrections.
No.
Maybe.
ETH would say that the Floquet Hamiltonian is 0 in the thermal phase.
So I guess what most of these expansions would say is not that the effective Hamiltonian is 0, but that it's highly non-local, and that there's no clean way of defining a thermodynamic
one. Sure.
And so any local observable, I guess, looks like infinite temperature, but we should discuss this because I actually wasn't familiar with that work. So heating is actually, I would say, still on a system-by-system case, somewhat open. And I'll actually talk a little bit about that today. But maybe when does it heat? And by heat, I should also be a little bit clear. I might put this in quotes sometimes. Heat just means absorb energy. It doesn't necessarily mean thermalize. And how fast. So these perturbative, essentially, arguments from those two groups tell you limits on when does it heat and how fast. And I would say it's not completely clear that these limits are saturated. In fact, it's clear in some cases they're definitely not saturated.
Right. There, so we've checked it for some sort of generic model, which is basically something like transverse field lighting with some extra field related durability, and then we find that the in terms of functional dependence, they're saturated.
Okay.
So heating rate goes
exponentially
e to the omega over whatever energy scale you have, right? But the prefactor, of course, so
okay.
In the real system, of course, the balance would be right. So the prefactor is,
it's like the order in the expansion, and that could be off by some
constant
ratio. Okay.
Right.
Okay.
But functionally, it seems to be
saturated. Okay, good. So for generic models, I guess the argument is for this. What I'm actually going to talk about today is a locally driven system, and there I think it's a little bit less understood. Please correct me if I'm wrong. Actually, boundary-driven system, to be more explicit. And then maybe the one other thing I would say, getting back to this question of more omegas, is in the presence of an environment, any sort of environment or dissipation, or that's not right. A drive that is not Floquet, it's pretty poorly understood exactly how these systems will behave. And in particular, I think there's quite a bit of room kind of here to develop a combination of Floquet methods with Kelvish methods, which to my understanding, are one of the best ways of treating environmental effects. I'm going to leave that pretty open because I don't have much to say. So, this is, to my mind, the state of where we are. Again, maybe now is a good time to pause for adding things to my list. What questions would you like everybody else in the room to answer? Or that you think you're going to answer tomorrow?
So I'm going to answer some questions or just...
Oh, God, no. I'll talk about a specific project that's related to this heating question, but certainly these guys, broadly, I'm not going to be able to answer today. But maybe, okay, so here's where I am in time. What I want to talk about, please. Is there...
Okay. Go for it.
Huh? Okay.
Go for it.
So heating is something that I think is very interesting, and specifically, what is known is that for stability against heating, what I want is a high-frequency drive and no resonances. So these arguments all come down to basically seeing when the first time a many-body resonance could occur, and then assuming that that's causing the heating. So you would think, okay, well then, good, I'm never going to have any resonances, but this is a problem, because while this might be good for stability, for engineering, you definitely do want resonances. So the simplest example of this is I have a qubit, which is, let's say, qubit frequency sigma z over 2, and then I'm going to drive it along the x-axis. So this has been all the time, and I mean all over the place, really. In order to engineer anything interesting, I damn sure better pick this frequency to be close to the qubit frequency so that I can actually do something that is meaningful in the rotating frame. So resonances are very good in the few body, and for engineering perspectives, they're very bad in the many body from heating perspectives. And the question is, what happens in between? Can we use the resonance to do something interesting, but not have the system heat to shit? So the answer is not completely known. Maybe I will, actually didn't write it up there, but there's some work we've done on resonant driving where you exactly are resonant with a commuting term, and you can actually show that that doesn't heat your system, and you can get some fundamentally interesting and new terms in Hamiltonian. That's work with Marin and Anatoly. But today I'm going to talk about boundary-driven systems. So the trick of boundary drive is, because I'm not driving my system as a whole, yes, it has resonances, but often on the time scale that you care about, you don't have to care about those resonances. So maybe I'll just quickly mention, I'm not going to even draw it, intro took a while, but there's some work done by a new Geddix group where they drive the surface states of topological insulators, which are Dirac cones, and they see flowgate block states. You've probably seen most of this data. Some recent ones where they actually show that those interact with free electron states above the surface of the sample. That is flowgate physics. It is a resonant drive. It is a surface drive. And actually, we did some theory to suggest that in some of their experiments, they actually do see the effects of this bulk surface resonance. You actually see coherent oscillations in the signal that come from the fact that your bulk and your surface are going to couple resonantly. So that's something that is published. Today I'm going to talk about something that is not published, which is gapless everything. So there was a gap surface, gapless bulk. Now let's make everything. In particular, the type of gaplessness I'm going to be interested in is a boundary-driven CFT. So imagine a semi-infinite conformal CFT conformal field theory sitting on the real axis. And then right at the edge, let's say x equals 0, I'm going to put on some boundary perturbation, and I'm going to start to drive this boundary perturbation periodically in some way. Specifically, I'm going to be interested in the case where the CFT and the bulk is the simplest CFT that most people likely know about, namely the transverse field icing model tuned to its critical point. And I should say, of course, this is only a CFT at low energies, but that's where I'm going to be interested. And at the boundary, I'm going to drive in a way that couples to the Ising degree of freedom. So the boundary is going to be some time-dependent boundary field times just sigma z on the last side. So this is a very well-studied problem in equilibrium boundary CFT. It's the first one that Cardi classified. In equilibrium, I actually don't know enough of the results to quote them. But in non-equilibrium, there are a few things that have been studied. For example, there's a very nice problem to study quench physics. So if I take my boundary field as a function of time, and I do something like this, I start out at zero, and I quench it to some positive value. Then zero to some positive value, what you find is that if you plot the Loschmidt echo, which just as a reminder, I start out in the ground state, so this is the initial ground state, and then I time evolve to time t, I take the overlap and I square it, Loschmidt echo, how much I return probability. What you find is a variant on, you know, usual CFT type physics. It starts at 1, it does some stuff here, where this guy is actually universal, but it's HB dependent. Crap, which I usually don't care about. And the interesting thing from most people's perspective is that late times, I forget about the fact that I actually had a boundary field in the first place, and I find an HB independent power law. This is maybe the somewhat surprising fact. And the way to see this, which comes out of arguments from Cardi back when he was developing the theory of boundary CFTs, is that you can actually show at late times, in imaginary time, so this is now position again, and this is imaginary time, that this Loschmidt echo is exactly given by starting with my ground state, so some conformally invariant boundary state. Your x less than zero doesn't exist. And then just hitting it with an operator, so just a single point-like operator, whose entire job is to take this spin here, which is called a free spin. It's basically, I mean, I have no field at the end, so it's just flopping around however it wants, and just fixing it to be up. Let's say my boundary field is up. And then after some amount of time in this so-called fixed region, I hit it with another boundary operator that goes back. And now at late enough imaginary times, I've just gone back to the free ground state. And you can actually show that this Loschmidt echo becomes the square. If this is the time tau between the quenches, the Loschmidt echo becomes just a two-point function in a CFT of these operators. Which from usual arguments of CFT is just a power law. T to the minus 2, 4, I guess, because I've squared it, times the dimension of these operators. And the dimension of these operators is actually some universal number, which is interesting. For example, here it's 1/16th if I do this quench, and this is then t to the minus, what is it, 1/4? It turns out that's actually been proposed by Joel and Roman, this last paper here, as a way of measuring a Majorana, because this is actually the scaling dimension of the Majorana in the field theory, and this is some universal power law that really doesn't care about anything else you do besides just do a quench and ask about critical state. Okay, so you can do other things. You can quench. Maybe just one thing I will mention is you could also, instead of quenching free to fixed, you could quench fixed to fixed. So I start out at minus, I quench to plus, and then I quench back. That's a different operator at the boundary. It has a different scaling dimension. So free to fixed, just to keep in the back of your mind, is t to the minus 1/4. And fixed to fixed, that's minus to plus, is t to the minus 2. So dimension is 1/2. All right.
So this, what the model you are considering now is just this Ising model?
It's really just the Ising model with a boundary field. A small boundary field. I should be a little bit careful here. much less than
some. You won't load disorder, load anything.
No, it's a very simple model.
Uh-huh.
But what I will say is, I mean, this is the model we're simulating. It's what we're studying. We're going to use the techniques of what's called boundary conformal field theory, which doesn't care about which particular model it is. And once you take those results, I can then replace this guy by, for example, an interacting icing model or a different CFT and a different boundary field. And most of the results I'm going to talk about, you can just essentially read off based on knowing the scaling dimension of this operator and knowing the operators of the bulk CFT. So it's a very simple model, but it generalizes readily. Okay?
Question I pose here, so from the experimental point of view, is there any motivation for studying this, or?
So, truthfully, I have my papers with experimentalists, so I can do shit like this every once in a while. That's my real motivation, is none, almost none. I just think it's an interesting problem. That said, the reason we came into it, which might eventually be useful, is if you imagine taking an actual CFT, let's say an icing, a myelin chain actually is what you want, and coupling it to a topological superconductor, in particular with a pi Majorana, what you can do is you can show that tunnel coupling these two, the Majorana acts like a boundary field on this last spin. And in particular, if it's a pi Majorana, what it's doing is it's actually going from minus to plus to minus to plus, exactly like the flow K problem I'm about to set up. And so there's some thought that eventually we're going to be able to use this to understand how you would measure, for example, pi Majoranas and how they would distinguish from non-pi Majoranas, which aren't clinches. That's the thought is coming into it, but realistically, I'm just solving a boundary CFT problem.
It's like kind of, I still don't understand the spectroscopy of this Majorana.
So if you were to have a pi Majorana here, and you wanted to show that you had a pi Majorana, there are ways of measuring the Loschmidt echo. Yeah, there's a couple of layers of extraction there. There are ways of measuring Loschmidt echo using, I think it's spectroscopic methods in quantum dots enmeshed in like semiconductors. And from that physics, if you actually were to measure the decay of this Loschmidt echo upon coupling your system to a pi Majorana, what I'm going to say actually will be a universal signature that tells you that you have a pi Majorana there.
So this Loschmidt echo, like in order to, you will do it on one qubit, on one spin, or on the entire thing? What's somehow
a just question? I mean, you want it on the entire.
So what's the
ground state of the CFT? So I mean, I'm time evolving the CFT, and I want to measure the overlap of the wave functions after time t within the spin chain, the icing chain.
So you involve it back and forth for how in time, or what is exactly?
No. So the actual way that they do it is, I'm not honestly sure I can reproduce it. There's some works by Atok and Momoglu, I think it is, where they show that they can do this in some Kondo-like problem. And I honestly, for the life of me, am not 100% sure.
I don't think it's quite that. It's a quench. They do some kind of quench, look at quench dynamics.
They look at quench dynamics, and from measuring spectroscopy of, I think it's the X-ray edge, they can actually extract, really, the Loschmidt echo, I believe. And from that, they can basically get the Loschmidt echo of the quenched Kondo problem, which is a variant on this one that I'm drawing here. If they could then take that Kondo dot and kind of floquet it, that's going to be very similar to the story I'm about to tell you, but it's not 100% clear. I will freely admit that, as of right now, we're mostly interested in the theory side. It's not one of the projects where I have a clear
I'm trying to understand what you're trying to do actually.
So what I'm actually trying to do is I'm trying to now consider taking this boundary field, and instead of just quenching it once, I'm going to periodically drive it in some way. So let's say from 0 to positive to 0 to positive, some period t, some amplitude hb0. And I'm going to ask, does the system heat If it doesn't heat, what can you say about the system? And then in principle down the road, what you can measure. And in particular, I'm going to be interested in the observable, which is this Law Schmidt echo. So after I do this for some amount of time t, particularly let's consider it stroboscopically, so after n cycles, I'm going to ask how my initial ground state has been modified into some new wave function. In particular, is there any universal signature of these overlaps from the way I'm doing the quench? That's the actual problem that I solve. Is that cool? Trying to set up, but this is actually the problem that we're going to be interested in solving. And again, as I say, I mean, naively you might expect that because I'm continuing to pump the system, it's just going to heat. But the answer I'm going to say is that it's much less trivial than that. So the kind of phase diagram that pops out of this, let me just plot it up and then I'll try to go over a couple of regions. I'm happy to discuss this more offline for those who are interested. Is if this guy is my driving frequency in units of some, let's say, UV scale, like the lattice, the hopping energy, and this is the strength of my perturbation. Up here, I'm driving it very strongly, much, much bigger than the lattice scale. This is not a CFT. There might be some interesting physics here, but I'm not going to be able to do much analytically. However, down here, it becomes CFT-like, and you might think, particularly if I drive fast enough, I have problems. It actually turns out there's a very nice statement that out here at very high frequencies, I actually get a high-frequency expansion that converges. And what we can show is that if you think about what the high-frequency expansion is doing, I start out quenching, let's say, between plus and minus and plus and minus. The high-frequency expansion goes in powers of the Fourier transform of this guy. So the leading component of it, as any NMR person will use, is just the time average. And so the time average of a quench from 0 to plus to 0 to plus is half of plus. And so what you can actually show is that in a very meaningful CFT sense, this guy, exactly as soon as I hit it, turns out the number I think is 2 in this model, becomes a perfectly convergent high-frequency expansion, and the late-time dynamics look exactly like a single quench. So even if I'm sitting epsilon above, there's some non-universal physics at short times, but all of the other terms in the high-frequency expansion between this, besides the single quench turn, actually go away. They're RG irrelevant. So there's some very nice limit out here where high-frequency expansion holds. There's some universal crossover scale, which goes as square root HB is like, square root of omega. That just comes from the fact that the energy scale corresponding to HB is actually HB squared, not really important. Where you get a crossover between what I will call the intermediate frequency regime and the low frequency regime. So at intermediate frequency, you get what you expect to get, which is heating. This guy converged because I have no resonances in my problem. I have dispersion relation that has width 2j in this case, and I'm driving at a frequency above 2j, so there's nowhere for my photons to go. As soon as I cross that, it just like very sharply doesn't converge because you see these resonances. And if I hop around enough in momentum space, it looks like I've heated. I've absorbed energy. I've not thermalized, to be clear. This is an integral model. But it's kind of what I will call heating in quotation marks. And actually, you can pick out effective temperatures. You can pick out the time scales of heating. They're universal in the limit where I have a small drive and also a small frequency. So around here, I can basically prove universality. But just for timing, I won't go into that. The one thing that I think is most interesting is this low frequency regime. So this low frequency regime, what am I doing? So specifically, I'm over here. In a low frequency regime, I am driving so slowly that you would naively expect resonances are a huge problem. The scale for resonances is actually much faster than the scale for anything else in the problem. In particular, I'm going to consider the order of limits. What is this? Omega is much less than HB squared over J is much less than J. HB squared, this is just, if you've ever done CFTs or even boundary CFTs. That's the effective energy scale corresponding to the drive. It's just saying that HP has scaling dimension 1/2. So this is like the energy of driving, and this is like the frequency of driving. But it actually turns out that this is a very nice regime, because in particular, if what I do is a positive to negative drive, so I have I start out at some negative amplitude, I go up, I go down, I go up, I go down. Essentially, my frequency is so low that I hear, I've quenched, I've relaxed, and I've gone past this HP-dependent non-universal crap, and I've almost reached an independent quench. I'm kind of sitting on that power law before I hit the next quench, before I hit the next quench. And so this is the regime where you actually might be able to apply all these very nice methods of boundary CFT. And in particular, one thing we can show is very nicely that if I take this guy, I have a bunch of quenches, I can just replace those by a bunch of boundary condition changing operators. And the Loschmidt echo after n cycles is just a 2-endpoint correlation function of these boundary condition changing operators. So that is something you can actually calculate in the CFT. It's universal, it's calculable, it has some non-universal coefficient C sub n, and then a power law that goes is for this plus to minus quench, t to the minus 2n, where n is the number of quenches that I do. However, the ratios of these coefficients are universal, and you can actually show that even those ratios are calculable and they come out exactly right. So the craziest thing that happens is now you say, okay, well, all my intuition from boundary CFT is what happened is I quenched, I flowed to infinity, so I turned on my boundary field and I just forgot about it after some amount of time. This is this HP-independent part. And so it really shouldn't matter how I do this ramp. In particular, if I do something a little smoother, which of course any experiment's going to have smoothing, periodic drive, a sinusoidal, or you can do a triangle wave. As soon as I get a little bit past the critical point, the boundary critical point, it should just flow to infinity and I shouldn't care. This turns out to be wrong, and actually in a very interesting way. So if I plot the Loschmidt echo as a function of t, for n equals 1, let's say, here was my data for the quench. When I ramp, I also get a power law, but that power law is completely different, t to the minus 2/3. And okay, it took us forever to understand where this was coming from, but it turns out that the answer is that this is actually a simple example of a problem that, as far as I can tell, hasn't been solved, namely Kibble-Zurich physics, so the dynamics of crossing the phase transition for a boundary critical point. And so I'm almost out of time. Let me just give you a snapshot of this argument, and then I'll close, which is the way Kibble-Zurich works is I have a diverging time scale in my problem, which in this case, is there's still a diverging time scale. It's this boundary field to the minus 2. And this is my boundary field. And now as I ramp this boundary field linearly, let's say, with respect to time, so this v is like the slope when I cross the critical point, then what you find is I'm basically in equilibrium, in equilibrium, in equilibrium, in equilibrium. At some time scale, the amount of time that it would take me to stay essentially adiabatic is longer than the amount of time I have left until I hit the critical point. So there's some characteristic time scale where I just fall out of equilibrium. This is no longer the right picture. This time scale is called the Kibble-Zurich time scale. You can derive this in bulk theories readily. You can actually use exactly the same expression here. It turns out it scales as v to the minus, what I'm going to call mu boundary z over 1 plus mu boundary z. Z is equal to 1, and that's the critical exponent for CFT. Mu boundary is the scaling dimension of h boundary, which is 1/2, 2. And so this in particular is v to the minus 2/3. And that sets a new dynamical time scale in the problem. If you take that and you put it into the original expression for the Loschmidt echo, so if I'm a little bit more careful, this is actually HB to the minus 2 over T to the 2N, because I know it has to be a universal ratio of the actual time scale that I put in and the effective time scale of my size of my quench. I can just replace this guy by the Kibble-Zurich time scale, and I find the power law that I expect. And so what you actually get is a redressing of your boundary condition changing operators, where these coefficients, which are actually set by the endpoint functions, don't change at all. But the dynamics of the problem actually changed, and in particular, the power law of how I cross this is changed because of boundary Kibble-Zurich, and I am out of time. So, thank you. That was my half-hour talk. Sorry.
But I'm actually a little confused about this phase diagram. So this is phase. I'm a little confused about this phase diagram. Is it a phase diagram at late times?
It's kind of a loosely defined phase diagram. It's just kind of a pictorial representation of the regimes we have in the problem. So here,
so it's not really
not a phase diagram. You should not think of it as these are phases of matter. You should think of it that in here sharply, there's a meaningful sense in which the high frequency expansion converges and I can understand it in terms of the effective single quench. In here, it's just some kind of soupy crossover, but in particular, in some regimes, we can really deeply understand what the physics is. That
and this exponent at late times is different for these different regimes? Or
yeah, so the exponent at late times is non-universal everywhere except for here.
I mean, exponents are universal.
That's so if you look after n quenches as a function of the period of the quench, in the intermediate regime, what I find is that I quench my system, but I don't wait long enough for it to equilibrate, for it to reach this power law tail before I hit it with the next one. So this replacement of the actual system by a bunch of boundary condition changing operators is wrong. It's just objectively wrong. And then it is universal in the sense that, I mean, I can in principle write down a scaling function, but that scaling function is not a power law. I can't say much about it besides just that it exists.
So when you're using, and this is my last question, when you're using the word heating, I mean, you don't really mean heating.
No.
Just nope. Something local.
The word I said heating almost throughout should be replaced with quotes, and it should just be an energy absorption.